6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never.
Thank you for listening to A Public Affair on 89.9 FM WORT. We are Madison's listener-supported community radio station. Today is June 10th, 2021, and I'm your host, Karma Chavez, in for my friend Alan Ruff again. Thanks to Rochelle for the opportunity to once again be back here with you today, Madison. I'd like to start out by giving some special shout-outs and thanks to those who called or got online to pledge during last week's show. I really want to thank you for your support. Those folks include the Peregrine Forum, Madison. They like Thursdays, A Public Affair, the BBC News, Democracy Now! Also, thanks to Harry in Madison, who loves also Thursday's APA, local news, and Labor Radio. Big shout out to Lisa Corrigan, who's my friend from Fayetteville, Arkansas, calling in and happy to hear me back on the air. Appreciate that. Thanks to Tim in Waterloo, likes Fire Worship, Access Hour, Bud Acres. Also, thanks to Susan in Madison for pledging last week. And just want to give a big shout out to Cynthia and Susan for answering phones for us during last week's pledge drive. So over the past several months, several Republican-controlled state legislatures have introduced various iterations of legislation designed to ban the teaching of critical race theory, sometimes limited to K through 12, and in other instances, including community colleges and public four-year universities. Purportedly emerging from concerns about the popular 1619 Project, an extensive journalistic project created by Nicole Hannah Jones that puts slavery and Black folks at the center of U.S. history, and angst created over what Republicans call woke philosophies. This is the latest attempt by Republicans to limit education and the academic freedom of educators in the name of protecting children. Several states have already passed these types of laws, and last week, Republican State Senator Andre Jacques of DePere and a handful of Republican colleagues introduced a set of sweeping bills that would prevent University of Wisconsin system campuses, state technical colleges, public K through 12 schools, and independent charter schools from teaching quote unquote critical race theory. These bills would ban 8 concepts from the classroom, including that one race or sex is superior to another, a person is inherently racist by virtue of his or her race or sex, a person's moral character is necessarily determined by race or sex. A person should feel guilty for past acts committed by people of his or her race or sex. And systems based on meritocracy are racist or sexist or designed to oppress people of another race. And I should just add, thankfully, as someone who studied critical race theory for a lot of years, it's great to know that critical race theory actually does none of that. I'm sure we'll get into that today. Although Governor Tony Evers would undoubtedly veto the bills, for many, the bills are worrying in the fact that they further entrench racism in the curriculum and marginalize Black, Indigenous, and other students of color. Others hold a cynical view of the motivations. UW education professor Gloria Ladson-Billings told the Wisconsin State Journal, "This particular movement at the legislative level is a red herring, a way to gin up fear. It's a political move, a way to rally the troops. Critical race theory is not the problem. The problem is our suspension rates are disparate. Our graduation rates are disparate, and who gets into advanced placement classes and who is placed in special education is disparate." Gloria Ladson-Billings is the former Kellner Family Distinguished Professor of Urban Education in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a position from which she retired in 2018. Professor Ladson-Billings is widely known for her research related to culturally relevant education, the racial achievement gap, critical race theory, and many other areas of interest. She's the author of several books, including The Dream Keepers, Successful Teachers of African American Children, Crossing Over to Canaan, The Journey of New Teachers in Diverse Classrooms, Beyond the Big House, African American Educators on Teacher Education, and Education Research in the Public Interest, Social Justice, Action, and Policy. She's the former president of the American Educational Research Association and a member of the National Academy of Education. Currently, she's a fellow at the Hagler Institute for Advanced Study at Texas A&M University. Professor Ladson-Billings, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you very much, Karma.
And if you're listening today and you'd like to join this conversation, you have some thoughts you want to share, please give us a call here in Madison at 608-256-2001, extension 9, or you can post to our Facebook page, A Public Affair. You can also tweet us at Wart Talk, and we'll be happy to get your questions or comments on the air. So, Professor Ladson Billings, I'd like to begin with your comment to the Wisconsin State Journal and about the rationale for Republicans introducing the suite of bills targeting so-called critical race theory, basically chalking it up to political theater. So if your analysis is right, and I'll say up front, I agree, then how should we respond to these bills being proposed?
Well, I think my initial response was to try to ignore some of this, but it's clearly not going away. And the reason that I made the statement that I made about what they're designed to do is because if you cannot win on policy, right, you have an incoming president in January who says, I'm going to tackle this COVID thing right away. That's what I'm going to do. And then he does it. He gets shots in arms. He's, you know, the numbers are going down. They're watching it. We're getting more information. He's more transparent about this particular disease. If he says we're going to get money out to people because people have lost their job. So if he's winning on policy issues, and of course, then Democrats are benefiting from that winning. And he's not been perfect, of course. We still got issues at the border. Let's be clear. But if he's winning at enough policy issues that he's maintaining a better than 50% approval rating, higher than his predecessor at any time,
right?
Then you've got to pick another area. And so the area becomes, let's have a culture war. Because culture wars get people excited. They get them revved up. And so that's really the place that this critical race theory debate is sitting. The problem is it's sitting there and it's getting mixed in with everything. I mean, it's sort of like critical race theory and the kitchen sink. you got anti-racism, you got diversity training, you got implicit bias. I mean, it's like it's all too much, right? But yeah. It gets people incensed because America's ongoing struggle is to come face to face with the issue of race and racism.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I'm glad you mentioned kind of that broader suite of things that are being targeted, because when I first saw these particular bills being introduced earlier this year, I, including in Texas, where I currently live, I couldn't help but think about particularly HB 2281 in Arizona in 2010, which targeted Mexican-American studies in the Tucson Unified School District, basically trying to ban ethnic studies. And I wonder then, thinking about that, or maybe several other examples that might come to mind, if you could contextualize and historicize the kind of targeting of teaching about race in public schools.
Oh, so thank you for really focusing in on the teaching aspect of it. I did indeed come into contact with Curtis Acosta and the folks who are working on the precious knowledge content. What's interesting about that is that they were literally revisiting a very similar walkout that the parents of these kids had experienced in Tucson. So these things come in sort of waves. You know, we can go back to 1960s, where there was a push at places like San Francisco State for ethnic studies. It comes in waves, and it's always important, I think, from a research point of view, is not to consider things one-offs, to be sure to begin to look for what's the pattern. You're probably well aware that we've just come out of the 100th year commemoration of the Tulsa massacre. And one of the things that I have said over and over to folks who are very interested in that is Tulsa's not a one-off. Look at the period between 1919 and 1925, and you will see close to 100 race riots, massacres, anti-Black racism, violence, literally, that occurred in the country. So the question of the curriculum, and the curriculum is always a contested site. I have my students read a very old book, 1934, The Miseducation of the Negro, by Carter G. Woodson. And they say, you know, except for the arcane language, because he uses the term Negro, in that book, we could be talking about today, the way that the curriculum marginalizes some groups and valorizes others. Critical race theory is merely saying, here we go again. Let's take a look at the way the curriculum continues to say, you don't belong. And, you know, the question that I often have with people who are critical of critical race theory is, explain for me then racial disparity. What's your explanation? Now, there's probably three prevalent ones. The first one that held sway for a very long time. You know, these people just not. In fact, indeed, you have people build an entire pseudoscience around eugenics, saying that this is a group, this group's smarter than this, literally rating and ranking groups. When that sort of fell out of favor, and although I think there's some people who still believe it, we moved to an argument that was much more about equal opportunity. Well, they'd be okay if they just had equal opportunity. But you know that every time we tried to equalize opportunities, there was a rollback. Brown versus Board, which we love to tout as an example of us doing the right thing, and it was the right thing, but it has been under steady attack. So you have the Milliken, the Dowell, you have Rodriguez v. San Antonio. To San Antonio, we've had case after case to chip away at Brown versus Board of Education. So equal opportunity, while in principle it sounds like a good idea, in effect, it is always vulnerable. Affirmative action sounds like a good idea, but then you end up in courts where people roll it back. So the third possibility to explain racial disparity is that it is systemic in some ways. And that's the place that critical race theory lies. If going into the bank doesn't allow me to purchase a house in certain areas, it's not that the banker doesn't personally like me, that it's somewhere in the system of banking that says, you can't buy a house over there, or we won't finance that. If I have trouble, even though I have the same educational credentials, but I can't make it past the interview committee, it may not be the individual sitting in the room as much as it is the systemic notion of, oh, is this person going to be a good fit? So that's where critical race theory sits. It argues for a more systemic look at racism. But what I've found just amazing is the degree to which people are conflating critical race theory with every other thing to be evil. So I heard an entire conversation about critical race theory and Marxism. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Marxism is a structural argument. Critical race theory is pretty much post-structural. So how does that fit together? But it's like, how many terms can I come up with to frighten the public?
Yeah, that is, I mean, I think that absolutely hits it on the head. And so I want to dig into critical race theory a little bit more with you. And, you know, I think it becomes shorthand, there's misconceptions. And so we have the expert here. So I'd love to just, you know, spend some time getting a masterclass with you about these things in detail. And to do that, you shared with me an article you published in 1998. A while ago, we should say, and it's about you introducing critical race theory in many ways to the field of education. And it is important to note that of your many important legacies, one of your key legacies, in fact, was really bringing CRT to education, legitimizing it as an area of study in which now dozens, if not hundreds of dissertations every year are published that have something to do with critical race theory. And so, just kind of wanted to give that context about you in relation to this. You wrote back then in 1998, it is because of the meaning and value imputed to whiteness that critical race theory becomes an important intellectual and social tool for deconstruction, reconstruction, and construction. Deconstruction of oppressive structures and discourses, reconstruction of human agency, and construction of equitable and socially just relations of power. Can you talk about what that means and if it still holds true to how you understand the project today?
Well, you know, sort of interesting to me because when we consider that, you know, I've been working on this for 30 years and probably have just, and it's taken 30 years for me to get any traction from the standpoint of people paying attention. I think if I come out with another innovation, I'll be, what, 103 when people begin to pay attention to it? That's really scary. I think one of the things that people are missing is the degree to which critical race theory is designed to have the nation live up to its own ideals. Mm-hmm. It's not asking for you to come up with some new ideals. We're four square on the Bill of Rights. We are four square on the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause. All we think that's really good stuff. We think the Constitution is full of really good stuff. But we also think that there is a gap between what's on the paper and what people are experiencing in their lives. And so in some ways, critical race theory is offering a kind of corrective that helps us narrow that gap. We have got to deconstruct notions that people are not entitled to a democracy. We have to deconstruct notions that it's okay for there to be wide disparities. We know that democracies suffer when there are huge disparities, when the wealth gap is so large. I mean the challenge of Russia right now is oligarchs, that you have people who have so much money, and then you've got this sort of underclass trying to find a place to live. That's not the society we want to be. So I think that's one of the things that we are trying to, quote, deconstruct. What we're trying to reconstruct is are the ideals that were set out in the beginning. And, you know, I'm not naive. I actually used to teach U.S. history as a public school teacher. I know that the Constitution didn't include someone like me.
Yeah.
But the beauty of the document is it has that much malleability that it actually applies to someone like me.
Yeah.
When I used to teach my eighth graders U.S. history, I didn't start with, you know, sort of the age of exploration or with the founding fathers. And incidentally, I taught it in Philadelphia, so you would think I would have taught it, would have started there. But I opened the class with a picture of Fannie Lou Hamer.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them, does democracy work for this woman?
Yeah.
That's the fundamental question. People like George Washington didn't need democracy. He was rich, he was white, he was male, he could have whatever he wanted. But a Fannie Lou Hamer, she had to fight to vote. She was beaten to vote. So that's the reconstructing. Yeah, the idea, let's reconstruct what it is that document was supposed to stand for. Then the construction is, how do we build things to be even more equitable? How do we get to a place where we're not still talking about first? 1995, I became the first Black woman to earn tenure in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin. People will clap when that's announced as a part of my biography or introduction. And I often say, don't clap.
Yeah.
That's embarrassing. This university began in the 1840s, I think 1848, if I'm correct. And here we are in 1995, just offering tenure to a Black woman in the School of Education. And education was one of the first departments. So that's the construction we have to do, where we get to a place where women, people of color, people who are part of the LGBTQ trans community, it's that we're not saying, we're not having to modify them and say they're the first.
Yeah.
That's the construction I think we're looking for.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on 89.9 FM, WORT is a public affair. We're talking with Professor Gloria Ladson-Billings about recent Republican attacks on critical race theory in schools. Call us here from Madison at 608-256-2001, extension 9. You can also post to our Facebook page, A Public Affair, or tweet us at Wart Talk if you'd like to join the conversation. I love what you just had to say there, and also it is astonishing the number of firsts that still exist. And I think you're right to say it shouldn't be celebrated. It should be a moment of reflection on what that really means about our institutions. And I wanted to pick up a little bit on the theme of what you're saying. So, you know, on the one hand, critical race theory is scary because of the critique it makes and all the things you just said. But on the other hand, what you also just said is, of course, it's actually about trying to make the nation live up to the ideals it set out for itself. And so, and I think part of that emerges out of its history in legal studies and the field of thought called critical legal studies, and then the critique of that from specifically Black scholars. And of course, you have Black Crit and other versions of critical race theory, too, that calls attention to some of the shortcomings. Even though critical legal studies was a very kind of leftist progressive thing, critical race theory emerges from that. So I thought it might be helpful on that kind of trend you're talking about with, you know, helping us to live up to the ideals, is some of the origins of critical race theory in law, if you could just give us a sense of that.
Well, I think it's sort of interesting that, I guess it was last week that we had the legislation proposed in Wisconsin, and I'm watching it on the TV news and thinking, this guy doesn't even understand it all started here. You know, Wisconsin is the site of the workshops that developed critical race theory. And it's probably difficult to get through the University of Wisconsin Law School without some exposure to critical race theory. So then I asked myself, so does that mean everybody since maybe 1980 with a law degree from Wisconsin is going to get that degree yanked? You know, that means half the legislature has to go. I mean, it's so, I mean, if you push it to, quote, the logical conclusion on here. But yes, there was a complaint, I think, around many women in law saying, you know, you guys are not dealing with the gender issues here. Mm-hmm. There were issues around class. But the critical race theorists were folks who said, yeah, but the elephant in the room here is still race. It's the place where we often end up dividing. And so that's what pushed it through. These workshops used to take place every summer. People like Derek Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw, Richard Delgado, Mari Matsuda, Charles Lawrence. I mean, some of the most eminent legal minds we know would gather to kind of hash out, you know, what's happening, particularly around inequality in the law. Mm-hmm. And critical race theory comes up because they say, this incremental approach, you know, filing a case, getting a judgment, trying to make good on the judgment, is taking too long. It is an incremental approach that will take us forever to get there. And if we look, for example, at things like, say, reparations in internationally, it didn't take the Germans decades to figure out we need to make some kind of reparative move towards people who lost their families, who lost their property in the midst of the Nazi regime. Similarly, I think critical race theory said we can't keep moving from slavery to sharecroppers and saying, okay, well, we're going to give a little bit more on this law. We're going to push a little bit more. I mean, let's face it. Most African Americans didn't have sort of universal franchise for African Americans till the Voting Rights Act in the mid 1960s. Mm-hmm. So you can tell me what you want about the 13th, 14th Amendment. Remember, it didn't include women. And then even when women with the 21st Amendment didn't include Black women. Yeah. So we're taking so long to get to things that we ought to be able to reach. And so critical race theory is really, in some ways, about expediency. Mm-hmm. How do we move more quickly towards justice?
Yeah. Absolutely. Professor Latson Billings, we have a couple of callers on the line that I'm going to bring on at this time. The first one is David. So, David, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you. And my comment, first, my comment is, of course, this country was born in slavery and extermination of the indigenous, and the right wing is apparently just frantically worried that that this would be reiterated. I'm reminded of Howard Zinn's People's History of the U.S., you know, 25 years ago. Don't you think this is a great opportunity? You know, there are all these people who haven't even heard of critical race theory, but now the Republicans are going to make it front and center, and this is a great opportunity to speak out about this, and there are going to be all kinds of people all the way from university professors on down to high school and middle school teachers who could presumably be put on trial for teaching critical race theory. I think, don't you think this is a great opportunity for the left? Thank you.
Thanks so much, David. Professor Latson Billings, do you have any thoughts about David's proposal?
Yeah, actually, I love David's proposal, and it reminds me, excuse me, that in addition to being an academic, I'm a parent. So as a parent, here's what I know. The minute you tell kids they can't say or do something,
right.
That's what they want to do. So these high school kids could have cared less about critical race theory. But now you're telling them they can't have any exposure to it, and they're just Googling it like crazy. They're looking for it everywhere. So in some ways, you're giving me the best advertisement I could ever have. But I want to, again, and you know, and I, you know, apologize here for my historical lens bias. But in 1894, the regents of the University of Wisconsin were confronted with the fact that there was a economist on campus who wanted to teach sociology. And the legislature said, no, we know, don't give him tenure because he shouldn't be teaching that. But the Board of Regents wrote, and I'm going to read it so I don't mess it up, but you've probably seen it having been on campus a lot. Whatever may be the limitations which trammel inquiry elsewhere, we believe the great state University of Wisconsin should ever encourage that continual and fearless sifting and winnowing by which alone the truth can be found. That plaque is on the front of Bascom Hall. It is the closest thing that this university has towards a mission statement. And I think as long as we stay true to this, you know, I'm not averse to having the debate, but right now we're not having a debate. We are having people just hurl grenades at something that they themselves don't know about. They haven't done any of the reading. It is a part of a playbook. All you have to do is look at what's going out from ALEC, what's going out from the Heritage Foundation, and you're just supposed to say it, and you're supposed to say it's bad. So I do agree that this is an opportunity for the left, but in some ways, I don't want to be dissuaded by the policy debates that we need to have. We still need to figure out what to do with the border. We still need to figure out how do we provide food security for people. We still need to figure out what environmental policy is going to be. That to me is much more central than a fairly esoteric theoretical debate. I mean, you know, I got paid to do esoteric stuff. That's the luxury of being a professor.
Yeah.
People in their real lives are worried about their economic situation. They are worried about their health care. They are worried about the environment. That's where I wish we could turn our gaze.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that. And thanks again, David, for the question. I'm also going to bring Thomas on the line here with another question. Thomas, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you for the program. It's very interesting. Just like David, I wanted to mention two things, that the Constitution of the United States and the Articles of Confederation enshrined white supremacy in this country, particularly for the white elite to run it, because even back then, if you were white, you couldn't vote unless you had land, and there were many other restrictions on it. And the thing is, I think this is important to have it in every school, because over the years, the textbooks have been determined by the place who produces most of them and where the most people are, and that seems to be Texas. So if you have this as a adjunct to your regular American history, then it's better for everybody. It isn't demeaning anybody, but it's bringing out the true America. And thank you for the program.
Thanks so much, Thomas. And I think you probably agree with a lot of what Thomas had to say there, Professor Ladson-Billings. What would you like to respond?
Well, Thomas, thanks for your comment. I will tell you that I'm someone who unfortunately has been down the rabbit hole of elementary high school textbooks. He's right that there are actually two states that determine what ends up in textbooks, Texas and California, and at least California from kindergarten through eighth grade. Above eighth grade, California allows teachers to select whatever, school districts to select whatever text they like. That means that 11% of the market determines the market for everybody. Mm-hmm. That's why the textbooks don't make any sense. So you'll be reading something and all of a sudden there's a picture of Sacagawea on the page and you're like, what's she doing over here? Because somebody lobbied, you know, oh, you didn't say anything about indigenous people. All right, boom, put her in there. Textbook publishers, they don't like when I say this, but they are amoral. They're not immoral. They're amoral. They will put anything in that book that will sell. Mm-hmm. So when you have strong lobbying from a state like Texas, and to a lesser degree, California, although I was in the 1990 textbook debate before I moved to Wisconsin, you get, you know, so much fire around ideological debates. Let's be clear. What we are teaching in elementary and high schools is not history. It's a school subject called history. So we teach a seamless narrative. History's messy. We're not teaching our kids historiography. We are teaching them, this is the agreed upon story. And I'm convinced that the story becomes narrower and more almost jingoistic in direct relationship to demographic shifts. Mm. And what do I mean by that? That before, when you were relatively assured that the students were going to be white, the teachers were going to be white, you had a notion that, okay, we all agree on the story, right? We agree that George Washington chopped down a cherry tree and didn't want to tell a lie. We agree that Abraham Lincoln walked, I don't know, 5 miles to return 2 pennies. I mean, it's that kind of seamless story that doesn't look at the history sort of warts and all. The history textbooks will never, ever do that. So we have to be able to bring in other perspectives. We have to have students weigh evidence. We have to have students understand the warrants that are being made for certain things. And what I find most interesting is a group of students who is most angry about what they haven't learned tends to be white students.
Yeah.
You know, teaching at the university, you know, I'd have white students say, well, how come I didn't know this? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm smart. I'm one of the, you know, they tell me I'm one of the smartest people in the state. I got into the premier institution. Why don't I know this? And so I think if we can't get our students to almost a kind of inquiry stance where they question what they see, not dismiss it, but say, you know, well, if this happened, then is this possible? I had interviewer, a journalist called me last week, and she said she's calling from Burlington, Wisconsin. And the first thing I said to her was, oh, Burlington, the sundown town? Now, she wanted to talk to me about critical race theory, but you're asking to talk to me from a place in which I, as a Black person, was not allowed to be in once the sun went down.
Right.
How many people in Burlington, Wisconsin know that about their town? That's not something I made up. That's something that is a part of your history. So we have to be able to look at our histories, warts and all. We cannot depend on the textbooks as the sole purveyor of truth, because they are not. And the more we start telling kids what they can't learn, trust me, the more they're going to dig and look for that information. So it's, in some ways, it's just a wonderful strategy.
The backfiring, I totally agree. And I think this is interesting to me, because you're pointing to, I think, two kinds of dimensions. And I think there are several obvious dimensions to critical race theory. But the one is sort of, it is critique in the critical, it's implied. But the other is content, and about introducing different forms of content, not in order to bias one way or another, but rather to provide information as the basis for inquiry, to be able to sift and winnow, as the Wisconsin motto says. So does that feel accurate to you, to describe in that way, that those are two of the crucial moves here, the critique and also the content, critical race?
It is. And one of the things I want to make sure I underscore is that I've probably told as many students, graduate students, not to use critical race theory in some of research they were doing, because I said, you don't understand it well enough. And students have heard me say this over and over. I'd rather there be no critical race theory than for there to be bad critical race theory, because the bad critical race theory leaves us open to attack. Well, often students want to share what I would think of as sort of a personal rant, and maybe something did happen to you that was race-based, but it may not actually be a good candidate for critical race theory analysis, because it doesn't take us to any bigger principle. Mm-hmm. And that's really what critical race theory should be doing. It should be helping you understand larger principles, not just, you know, this person followed me around in a department store. That happened. But what is it an example of? Mm-hmm. So I even had people say, oh, you know, I tried to publish something on critical race theory and they just rejected it. You know, these white editors are not going to publish it. And I said, no, don't jump to that conclusion. It probably didn't get published because I said no. Because I get tons of these manuscripts.
Yeah.
And if they're not well researched, if they're not well written, they shouldn't be published. It has to stand the same scrutiny of any refereed or juried manuscript. So I'm looking for rigor in this, you know, in that we have, again, warrants for the assertions and claims that we make. I mean, one of the arguments of critical race theory that people haven't talked very much about is the interesting relationship between race and property.
Yes.
So think about whenever someone tries to make a human rights claim against the United States, you know, we usually just scratch our heads or laugh. What? No, what are you talking about? Well, critical race theorists would argue that claim doesn't make sense because the nation is more to property rights than human rights. Go back and look at our jurisprudence. You can end up spending more time in jail for a property violation than a human violation. You know, if we were focused on human rights, the most dastardly thing you could do in a society would be an offense against a human being. That's mm-hmm. not the case. Mm-hmm. It's property. Even if you look at, you know, newscasts, when there's destruction, they give us a figure for the cost of the property destruction.
Yeah.
They don't give you a figure for human life destruction.
Yeah. No, yeah. Absolutely. I want to return to this point in a second. I just want to check in and remind people that if they're just joining us today on 89.9 FM WORT's A Public Affair, that we're talking with Professor Gloria Ladson-Billings about critical race theory and the recent proposal by Republicans in the state Senate. We have just about 13, 14 minutes left in the show. So if you want to join us, now is the time to do it. Call us at 608-256-2001, extension 9. Jump on our Facebook page at A Public Affair or tweet us at Wart Talk. So I want to pick up on this question of property because I love the way you talked about it in your 1998 article, as well as other work that you've written. But there's another specific piece connected to education and the property argument that I'm hoping you might take a time to connect and unpack a bit, which of course is property taxes funding education. And so maybe you could make a link between these different ways that property manifests in these conversations.
So one of the things that I have the most difficult time explaining as I travel the world, my international colleagues don't understand how we fund education. They don't understand how we do education, period, because we do it based on 50 different provinces, or 51 if you add Puerto Rico, that every state gets to determine its own education policy that has to do with the Constitution and the Clause 10 and the fact that if it's not in the Constitution, then whatever it is reverts back to the state. And so education became one of those things. Most modern democracies and even some of the developing, many of the developing nations have education as a state function. That it's that important that we just don't leave it to a kind of patchwork of decisions and rules about it. So because we have each state determining what education policy should be, one of the ways in which the states are able to fund it, because since it's their bailiwick, then they have to fund it, has always been around property taxes. But that in and of itself creates inequity. Because if what you're saying is those people who live in this community that you've already redlined and you've already said that this property is less value, have less resources with which to fund education. And I know that we've had all kinds of examples. Wisconsin is a good example of trying to do school funding equity approaches. In fact, one of the legal strategies that I would say more liberal lawyers are taking now is that they're no longer talking about racial equity in schools. They're like, let's get funding equity. I've been an expert witness on two major cases, one in New York, one in South Carolina. We won both cases. Here's the problem. You can't collect. So you can prove, you can prove to the courts that the state is inequitable in its funding of different schools and districts. But then what the state will say is we don't have the money. We can't give it to them. So, you know, you win the moral victory, but it doesn't change anything. So the problem, I think, with funding via property taxes is we're suggesting that our children are citizens of a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Or that they're citizens of just the state, but they are actually U.S. citizens. They belong to the nation, and the nation has taken no responsibility for them. So that's a perfect example, I think, for critical race theorists to say, you know, if you were serious about schooling and equity in schooling, we'd come up with another way to fund our schools. You know, but that's a hard debate to have. People literally move to certain neighborhoods because of schools. I think the other thing I tried to do in that article is give examples of how other quote property exists. For me, as a someone who was a curriculum theorist, the curriculum is a property. You know, the fact that you could have 2 10th graders and one of them is sitting in a geometry class and the other one is sitting in a general math class. And that determination is often linked to race and ethnicity or even language, suggests to me that the value of the curriculum as a property is higher in that geometry class than it is in general math. And so just literally going through the curriculum and determining, oh, this is okay for those kids is already telling us that certain kids are not entitled to access to high-value curriculum. So there's, I mean, we can sort of analyze ourselves ad infinitum, but I think there's really good examples of the way in which schools continue to play out this property disparity.
Yeah. Well, and it makes me think, too, if we go back to early education theorists, democracy theorists like John Dewey, and the whole idea of a public education is to create good citizens. But what the...
It appears we have lost Karma, and we're going to wait for her to come back on. But in the meantime, we actually do have a question from a caller. Frank, you're on the line.
Yes. I have a question regarding issues of folks around Wisconsin that really have no understanding of what critical race theory is, and what type of information would be pertinent for them who aren't necessarily, that's not necessarily as high academic as a lot of your writings and other CRT type materials, something that would be much more accessible for folks. Because what we're finding out is that people have no understanding of it, and they think any type of criticism of anything of systemic racism is looked at as critical race theory. And what would be some good tools to give people, just kind of layman tools, to get an understanding of CRT?
Excellent question. I have two things that come to mind right away. The first one is a book by Derrick Bell called Faces at the Bottom of the Well. Very easy to read. It was a trade bestseller. And Bell does a great job of using storytelling as a way to illustrate principles of critical race theory. So that would be one that I'd grab right away. A second one might be a book by Richard Delgado and Jean Stefancic titled Introduction to Critical Race Theory. Years ago, Richard actually thought he might be able to penetrate the high school market. And I told him, I said, people are not going to buy this. They're not going to buy the idea because it's just where it might fit in the curriculum is kind of dubious. But the book sold pretty well, I think, in the general market. So those two books, straightforward, not inundated with legal citations, but just really kind of tell the story. Those are places that I would direct people.
That makes sense. And I'm here with you now again. I'm so sorry, Professor Ladson-Billings.
Okay.
My internet crashed in the middle of answering, so I'm glad that Rochelle could jump in and we can get a caller on the air there. And so we just have a couple minutes left in the show, but I do have a couple other quick questions that I want to get to, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
One of the things I want to do is, in that 1998 essay again, you offered a word of caution to other educators about bringing critical race theory into their work, and I think you've already intimated this in some of our conversation, but I want to read something that you wrote and then see what you make of it today. So you wrote, "Adopting and adapting critical race theory as a framework for educational equity means that we will have to expose racism in education and propose radical solutions for addressing it. We will have to take bold and sometimes unpopular positions. We may be pilloried figuratively or at least vilified for these stands. Ultimately, we may have to stand symbolically before the nation and hear our ideas distorted and misrepresented. We may have to defend a radical approach to democracy that seriously undermines the privilege of those who have so skillfully carved that privilege into the foundation of the nation. We will have to adopt a position of consistently swimming against the current." So what do you make of your words today?
I didn't realize I was a clairvoyant because that was 1998. But I will say that, the beauty of what is actually happened in the nation over the last 18 months or so is that what happened with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and so many others have brought to the national consciousness the issue of disparity in ways that no academic could. And I will also say that our youth, our young people, took to the streets, mm-hmm. and they did not take to the streets just as a block of Black or Indigenous or Latinx folks. They took to the streets as Americans to say, hey, Black Lives Matter. You're not going to put this over in a corner somewhere. You're not going to say this is a bunch of radical folks. You're not going to say that these are people who are anti-democratic. They are showing you what democracy can and should be. So I think it's been the activists who have done the work of engagement. They don't need the rhetoric of critical race theory. They are mm-hmm. standing on the promise of democracy. And it's the kind of thing that I'd hope would happen, that we would really, you know, if people ask me all the time, they say, well, what can we do in schools? I said, you know, the most radical thing we could do is to give Black and Latinx students a quality education. That would be so radical. Can you imagine that? That we really, really educated these kids. That's really kind of been my own sort of personal mission. So I'm excited about the times we are in, because I think we're in times when young people are impatient for democracy. They are not going to wait another generation.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying there. And I think, you know, the other side for me is thinking about, we have all this possibility. We do have all this hungering and driving toward democracy, and yet we still have these challenges. And I guess maybe just on a last note here is, like, while Republicans get critical race theory wrong, obviously, where they're right is in the fact that it is a threat to all that they hold dear. And so I think there's one way to respond to this, which is to say, oh, no, it's not that. But how would you approach challenging these attacks? And we have just about 30 seconds.
Well, I've done a fair amount of work in South Africa. In fact, I'm really excited that last week I received an honorary degree from the University of Johannesburg, even though I couldn't go there because of COVID. And watching the way that people took charge of their democracy, that they realized, you know what, we have a voice, to me is encouraging, because I think what's happening here is that as the demographics change, people worry. People are trying to protect something that is almost indefensible at this point. So I'm encouraged. I think people will push towards democracy. And, you know, I've said this to a couple people. I haven't said it publicly, but I actually think that the current president might be the more radical guy in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, we have to wrap it up here. Thanks so much, Professor Latson-Billings, for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks once again. I'm your host, Karma Chavez. You've been listening to A Public Affair. Disregard the mainstream media distorted.